talking about things that should be pretty evident. The biblical writer and again Eve would have sort of known that, you know what, snakes don't talk. and so when you have this again when either in terms of how it's written or the event itself, you know, this thing that we refer to as the fall, you know, it's like, look, since snakes don't talk, there's probably something bigger going on here. And of course, the telegraphing, the messaging is that this is not really a member of the animal kingdom. It is, in fact, a divine being. Okay, because, you know, this is not something animals do. And we have other passages, especially those of us who are sitting here with the New Testament. I mean, we know that this was, you know, ultimately the figure that the New Testament refers to as Satan. So we know it wasn't just a member of the animal kingdom. Well, why is it that when we look back in the Old Testament, it's like, oh, well, they wouldn't have been able to figure that out. They, you know? Or the writer, when he said, Nakash, he really thought it was a snake, you know. Again, I'm not ruling out that there could have been a serpentine appearance. All I'm saying is, look, they understood this was a divine being. That's what I'm saying. Now, Nakash, as a term, actually would have telegraphed that this is more than an animal, because it depends on, and I think this is deliberate, there's actually something like a triple entendre going on here with Nakash, because as a noun, it means serpent. But there's also a nakash that is a verb, which means to practice divination. Again, communicate, dispense divine knowledge. Now that alone tells you that, okay, there's something revelatory going on here, because a snake wouldn't know that. And not only that, he wouldn't be able to tell me, okay? So, I mean, you got that going. And then as an adjective, nakash refers to luminescence, like a shiny appearance, okay? And so if you're an ancient Israelite reading this, all three of those things are tracking through your head. And again, because you know snakes don't talk, you're thinking, okay, the writer's doing something to me that probably what I really need to get out of this is that not we have this crazy woman talking to a serpent, but we have... We have a confrontation brewing here, because this animal is actually not an animal. It's actually a divine being, and something's going to happen here, something that isn't good, because God's supposed to be the one dispensing divine knowledge. He's the one that's been talking to Adam and Eve. What's this guy doing? You know, again, coming to her like, hey, I really know what the scoop is, that kind of thing. And again, it's just a way that they would have processed it. Those things would have been floating around in their head, whereas when we read it, we all sort of only think of one. And again, it's just we're a little more limited in our perspective, you know, in how we read the text. It struck me one day, you know, again, I've heard that, oh, snakes used to have legs, you know, and then for the proof for that, you'd actually hear creationists use evolutionary biology as a proof for that. Well, you know, the scientists say little appendages and a little this or that. And it's like, do you realize what you're doing here? You're going down this path that you think is really informative, you know, right now. But if I were an evolutionist, I'd say, you know, I've just really got you in a place that you don't want to be. But anyway, you know, yeah, I've heard it too. The Deuteronomy 32 worldview, I use that phrase a lot. And what I'm referring to is you go back to Deuteronomy 32 verses 8 and 9. This is sort of where it springs from. And again, the ESV, I think, does a really good job with this, because the ESV is textually up to date. It actually incorporates Dead Sea Scroll reading of, you know, manuscript readings in the passage, which is kind of nice. It's unusual that the translations do that. They usually put it in a footnote, but ESV has it right, you know, in the running text. And it says, when the Most High, and we don't have real trouble figuring out who that is, when the Most High divided up the nations, and again, that's not a big leap, you know, like, oh, you know, it's not a Jeopardy question. I mean, when did he do that? Well, that again, that's the Tower of Babel event, Table of Nations, Genesis 10, Tower of Babel event, Genesis 11. So when the Most High divides up the nations, he divided them up according to the number of the sons of God. That's what the ESV says. That's what the Dead Sea Scrolls say. Septuagint also reads that. Of course, the King James doesn't. And a lot of other translations don't, because they follow the traditional Masoretic Hebrew text at that point, again, which was produced before we had things like the Dead Sea Scrolls and whatnot. You know, they could have got it from the Septuagint, but you know, people said, oh, it's just the Septuagint. Well, when the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, you can't say that anymore. It's like, oh, well, it's also the oldest Bible we have. That's what it says. So, you know, again, for me, that's not a problem. That's a good thing, you know, to discover that. But it actually makes great sense, because let's just take it. When the Most High divided the nations, he divided them up according to the number of the sons of Israel. That's what the King James has, children of Israel. Well, how does that make any sense? I don't need to be a textual critic to figure this out, because guess what? If you go back to the Tower of Babel event, when the nations are divided and scattered, there is no Israel there. Okay, there is no Israel in the Table of Nations. Why? You know, again, this isn't a Jeopardy question either. It's because we haven't gotten to Genesis 12 yet, when Abraham was called, and you get Israel, okay? So to read the sons of Israel in Deuteronomy 32:8-9 makes no sense at all. But if you read sons of God, then you got something going, because verse 9 says, you know, again, I'll just back up to verse 8. When the Most High divides the nations, he divides them up according to the number of the sons of God. But Israel, this is verse 9, but Israel is Yahweh's portion. Jacob, another name for Israel, is his inheritance. And the parallel passage in Deuteronomy to this is Deuteronomy 4:19-20, where Yahweh, the God of Israel, takes Israel as his own. And the rest of the nations are allotted to other gods, and vice versa. The gods are allotted to them. They, you know, it's a marriage made, you know, not quite in heaven, but, you know, they belong to each other, you know. And so what the Deuteronomy 32 worldview is, that God punished the nations. He judged the nations because after the flood, they were not dispersing on their own like he had told them to do. Instead, they gather in Babylon, at least a lot of them, and they're building a ziggurat. And why would you build one? A ziggurat was part of a temple complex. You do that to locate the deity, to bring the deity to you on your terms so that you can barter with it. Typical polytheistic religion. And Yahweh's like, okay, this is the wrong thing to do. You know, I will not be tamed. Not only did I not tell you to do this, but I will not be tamed. You know, I'm not at your beck and call. It's the other way around. And so he punishes them. He disperses them. Says, fine, you don't want me to be your God. You're not going to listen to me even after the flood. Well, fine. I'm going to allot you to lesser divine beings, to sons of God. And the original plan, we learned from the book of Acts and a few other places, the original plan was not to eliminate the nations from ever being part of God's family again, because that would have been contrary to the Edenic intent. Rather, it was so that they would learn of the true God. There was going to be a pathway back, and that pathway specifically was Israel, because right after God does this, you get into Genesis 12, and the Abrahamic covenant is given, and part of the covenant is, through you, all nations of the earth will be blessed. You know, I mean, they're still there, but from now on, Israel is Yahweh's portion, and Israel will be the conduit through which anyone who wants to relates to me. And Israel was supposed to be a kingdom of priests. They were supposed to spread the good rule of God. They were supposed to be different, a peculiar people. You know, all these things that we read in the Old Testament were designed to alert the other nations to who the true God was. Israel becomes elect, which has nothing to do with salvation in the Old Testament. Again, this is a concept that Christians regularly mess up. Election has to do with the fact that you, above, you know, out of all the other ones, are chosen to receive truth. You have access to who the true God is and what the true God is really about. You still have to believe it. That's the salvation part. But the fact is that you have access to the truth, access to the oracles of God, and nobody else does. that's what election is. And you still have to embrace it by faith and so on and so forth, you know, as we see in the rest of the Old Testament. But this whole worldview, getting back to the original question, is the rest of the Old Testament is Yahweh against the gods and Israel against the nations. And all this talk about having the nations being brought back in, because according to Psalm 82, the sons of God, the sons of the Most High, the Elohim that are assigned to these nations become corrupt. Okay, Israel is seduced into worshiping them. They don't turn around and say, whoa, 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 whoa. You know, don't worship us. You're supposed to worship the truth. No, they don't do that. They become corrupt, and they have to be judged. So God has to judge them too. And all of this is going to culminate, you know, in the day of the Lord. There are passages in the Old Testament talk about the gods of the nations, the rulers of the nations being judged, you know, at the last day, the day of the Lord, the nations being brought back. It starts, you know, when we get the New Testament going with, first there's Jesus and cosmic geography, and what he does and says and where he goes really matters. I mean, there are things going on there. The book of Acts is sort of the beachhead for reclaiming the nations. All of this has deliberate messaging in it that we just never get to on a surface reading of various passages. Like Acts 2 is a great example. I mean, how many times have you heard a sermon on Acts 2?
Right.
And the fact that it progressively, from east to west, reverses the course of the nations that were disinherited in Genesis 10. You know, and Paul's ambition, his sense of earnestness to get to Spain when he writes to the Romans. I mean, what's that about? Well, he just likes the place? No, it's Tarshish in Genesis 10. It's the westernmost point. And the progression of the gospel goes from east to west through Paul's life. It's deliberate. It's telegraphing this mission to reclaim the nations. And Paul equates that with the fullness of the Gentiles. This needs to happen before the Lord can come back. And it's very clear to him. He's the living embodiment of this mission. You know, now, of course, you know, God knew a little bit better, you know, as far as, hey, there are other nations out there that you're not aware of yet, you know, and the gospel needs to go through the whole earth. But Paul is very clear because he knows his Old Testament. I mean, he knows what being the apostle to the Gentiles means. But we just miss a lot of this stuff on because we read very surface, and what we hear in church is very surface in nature, from what the kind of things you could really drill down into.